You're listening to KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM. For our virtual listeners, we hope your device is locked onto our website at kptz.org. I'm Marianne McNellis, and this show is called Our Town. The show highlights some of the diverse personalities that make Jefferson County, Washington, so very special. The COVID crisis has changed our lives dramatically. At KPTZ, many of us haven't been inside our studio for over a year. I am actually inside the studio today for the first time since February 26, 2020. With an abundance of caution, most of us have not using the studio equipment to record. We have a technical workaround. We create and record the show without even visiting our world headquarters in that sweet little trailer in the parking lot of the Mountain View School. But like everyone else, we're ready, willing, and frankly, desperately anxious to move to the next step. For us, it might mean we finally get to occupy our new studio at Fort Warden. That's our impossible dream. What's yours? Are we ready to take back our town and our lives? I saw a young woman in short shorts zipping down a hill on a skateboard. Who was she? Who are the masked people patiently standing in line to buy bread at Pan de Amore? And who was in that crowd down at the American Legion, gathering to honor some fallen soldiers? By the way, most of them were not wearing masks. There are many stories here, many different people with many different lives and hopes. The purpose of our show, Our Town, is to share the stories of some of those people. Over time, we'll be talking with firefighters and foodies, bus drivers and baristas, the lawyers and the ladies who lunch. We try to find out what makes them tick and what they think about living in beautiful Jefferson County amid the deer, the otter, and even the magnificent soaring eagles. Jefferson County has been spared some of the worst of the COVID crisis. However, whether you're vaccinated or not, I worry about the psychological health of many of our citizens. Think of the families who spent over a year simultaneously sheltering in place, homeschooling the kids, and working remotely. Walking the dog is a welcome treat for both the dog and the master. People have been cooped up for over a year now. Nerves are frayed. Violence bubbles behind every corner, even here on the edge of nowhere. Take care. Be patient. We're seeing a light at the end of the tunnel, although you better get used to perpetual masks in some situations. Listening to Our Town is a way to get to know some of the amazing people around us. Listening to Our Town is a way to open up your world to new people. My guest today is Mark Hilt, the owner of Shining Star Cycles, which is a mobile bike repair business. Mark will come to you to fix your bike. He also parks his van, which is really a mobile bike shop, at his place out by the Olympic Discovery Trail. That way, he can service both tourists and locals attempting to take that gorgeous ride. When he's not repairing bikes, Mark puts on a different type of gloves and joins the landscaping team at the beautiful, historic Jefferson County Courthouse. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Glad to be here.
But before we talk about your innovative way of serving our ever-growing bike community, let's start with a little background. Are you a local boy born and bred on the Olympic Peninsula?
Yeah, I was born in Port Angeles and graduated from high school in Port Angeles.
And how long had your family been in that region?
Since the early 1900s, late 1890s, my grandfather was one of the first elk hunting guides up in the Olympic National, what is now the Olympic National Park.
Cool.
My great-grandfather, I mean.
Okay. And you mentioned you went to high school in Port Angeles. I'm always curious about people's high school experience because basically people fundamentally changed during those years. What were you like during that point in your life?
Well, you know, when you grow up out there, you either are into hunting and fishing or you're serious, just not, you know. And so I was like every other kid. I wrestled when I was in high school. Most of them played football. And I hunted and fished. You know, it's kind of what everybody did up there. I had no aspirations to be a logger, that's for sure.
Okay. Did you have a vision of what you wanted to do when you so-called grew up?
You know, at one point in my life, I wanted to be an astronaut, but I figured out that I wasn't going to make it through college long enough to do that. So, you know, I really didn't.
Well, but most people do figure out that they've got to earn some money somehow in order to, you know, have a lifestyle. So what were your thoughts on that?
Oh, well, you know, so you're talking about like when you're 19. When I was 19, I knew that I wanted to race bicycles. You know, I knew I was never going to make any money out of it. But at that point, I was pretty dedicated to pursuing my interest in bicycle racing.
And did you race in some amazing races?
I did. I actually even went as far as to go to Europe at one point. You know, I raced some, I did have some, they might be considered dubious honors. You know, I've set the national time record before, time trial record, racing the national championships. I've done Ironman length triathlons. You know, I raced for 20 years straight.
Wow. So I've heard the term Ironman tossed around a bit, but I frankly don't really know what it entails. What is that race really?
Well, a true Ironman race, which is the name of the very first event, the full Ironman is considered 2.4-mile swim. Then you have 112 miles on the bicycle, and then you have a run of 26.2, which is a full marathon. They're all done continuous in that order.
Wow. And so you completed some of these?
Yeah. Yeah. They're pretty fun.
Yeah, I guess they would be. But, you know, probably you still had to pay rent and buy food and things like that. So what did you do for employment?
Oh, I wrenched in bike shops.
And so did you do that for a number of years or did you start your own? What happened?
Well, I got lucky. A shop in Olympia picked me up. I was wrenching in Port Angeles and there was a shop in Olympia that picked me up and they had a custom frame builder there who took me under his wing to basically do high-end bikes. And I worked there for a couple of years. And then my boss, who is one of the best bosses I've ever had, he once took me aside and said, "Hey, Mark, I think that you should probably open your own shop. You know, you're working too hard for me, so you should go do the same for yourself." So I moved to Port Townsend and started a bicycle store.
Wow. What year was that?
1979.
And describe Port Townsend back in 1979.
Well, the center of Port Townsend, you know, really had to be considered the town tavern. You know, really, you know, even though, you know, some of the locals looked at it disparagingly, you know, it really was the hub of town. When I moved here, I would say probably at least 30% of the buildings downtown were boarded up. You know, you could buy one of those Victorians for under $20,000. They were a wreck, you know, and it was a town of really relaxed, you know, if you want to use the term that everybody used, hippies.
And so was there a crying need for a bike shop?
Yeah, there was no bicycle store here. There was a few guys that were dabbling at repair, but they weren't actually inventorying any of complete units, nor were they actually inventorying, you know, stock to be able to readily do any repairs.
Okay, so was your shop a success back in the 70s and 80s?
Well, as successful as I made it, you know, I mean, I spent sometimes too much time training, and so therefore I wasn't really taking care of business as well as I could. And sometimes it was as good as it was going to be based on my lifestyle. And, you know, I was really in it to race, and that was kind of the bottom line.
The bike industry, you told me this the other day, has actually gone through some sort of what people might call boom and bust cycles, where they're popular and then not popular. And you were telling me about mountain bikes and how that changed the industry. Can we go through some of that?
Yeah, you know, so the road bike industry, after the 1984 Olympics, when Alexei Graywall won the first American gold medal in the road race, there was a big boom for road bikes. It really took off right then. But that only lasted for about maybe 3 or 4 years. And then there was this other industry that was coming along that was kind of fledgling industry. I was actually racing mountain bike races and by the mid-80s when hardly anybody was even doing it. And the industry was really kind of stagnant. It didn't really look like it was going anywhere. And that was kind of where the low point of the bike industry was when I decided to get out of it because I just didn't see a future in it. Mountain bikes hadn't taken off. Road bikes were a low point. What was wrong was that I didn't really consider the American innovation. So the mountain bike industry caused a whole bunch of Americans that were sitting around tinkering to suddenly come up with all these ways to make a mountain bike and improve it to be basically it's a pedaled motorcycle. You know, they used motorcycle technology and just reduced it down to very, very small, light parts. It was pretty amazing, and I misjudged it.
You're listening to KPTZ, Port Townsend, 91.9 FM. The show is called Our Town. I'm your host, Marianne McNellis. Our Town profiles some of the fascinating people who live and work on the Olympic Peninsula. Today, my guest is Mark Hilt, owner of Shining Star Cycles. Mark has been talking about his early days and opening a bike shop here in Port Townsend in 1979, But he also is just starting to explain that perhaps he misjudged the market because, in fact, he sold that bike shop and went in a different direction for a while. So tell us what happened.
Well, I went to another direction that is kind of a dead-end street. It's called landscape and nurseries. You know, there's another boom and bust industry, you know. So that pretty much, you know, for me, the bust part of the landscape industry came in the 2009 meltdown. I had a bamboo nursery at the time. And as long as there was a big construction boom going on, you know, you could sell lots of plants for new landscapes. But as soon as there's no construction, you're just sitting around watering plants waiting for the next boom. So I got out of that.
You had the original bike shop was also called Shining Star Cycles, right?
Yeah, I had trademarked the name.
Ah, you trademarked the name. So you were able to basically slip back in.
Yeah. So when I got my business license through the state and used Shining Star, Washington state law had changed. And because my previous business that I had, the most recent, had been Bamboo U, which was a nursery, they made me create Bamboo U doing business as Shining Star Cycles. But I'd had the name on the books already.
Was it easy to slip back in?
Oh, no, not at all. As a matter of fact, I spent 2016 sitting around trying to figure out how to do it. And one of my biggest problems was to get the wholesalers to deal with me. And one of the biggest wholesalers in the United States is a company that's called QBP. And my first approach to them was an absolute shut the door in the face. Absolutely. They were not going to deal with me in any way, shape, or form. They were totally, totally against the mobile bike industry, of which the mobile bike industry has been going in Europe for a long time. And it's been going in Canada for a long time. So it isn't new. But I can understand where they were coming from, because there were lots of people who wanted to be a mobile bike shop, quote unquote, so that they could get bike parts cheap for themselves at wholesale, and they'd be working out of their Subaru and go do poor quality work and all the rest of that stuff. I understood where they were coming from. So after, most of the other big companies came on board relatively rapidly, but QBP actually made me, when I finally got the van, all the graphics on the van, they finally said, you know, okay, we'll do it. But at first, I could only get what they considered a repair part. Okay. Like a handlebar bell was not a repair part, so therefore I couldn't buy one.
Describe what you mean by a mobile bike company.
Essentially, it comes down to is that the customer doesn't have to take their unit to any place to have repaired. I come to their place and service it. And the van is full of most normal components and even a lot of oddball components. Like, see, dating back to bikes from the 80s and 90s, most of those could be serviced too. So unless it's some sort of odd repair, you know, generally speaking, I can go and do all the service, brake adjustments, derailleur adjustments, rebuild shocks for mountain bikes, you know, put new tires on for most units. And most of the work, I'm there within 24 hours.
Wow. I had the opportunity to look in your van, and I was frankly amazed by the amount of stuff you've got in there. I
yes,
realize your
really
inventory good. Changes, but can you describe what you typically would have in the van at any point in time?
Yeah, it would be, so if you consider that, let's say a child's bike would normally have a 20-inch tire on it. And then if you went up to the mountain bikes, they'd have a 29-inch tire. So there's a few tires of each design in every one of those sizes, and tubes to go with all those sizes, and the normal cables that it takes to actuate the brakes. If you have hydraulic brakes, there's the ability to actually change the oil and bleed the hydraulic brakes. There's derailleurs, chains, the gear clusters for the back for the multi-speed bikes, and you know, and even the internal speed stuff, three speeds and stuff like that. You know, those things can all be serviced.
Wow. But you also are sort of straddling both worlds. You still are involved in landscaping. Can you tell us what you're doing there?
Yeah, so the courthouse, it's got a remarkable landscape that was done about 15 years ago, and it was overplanted. Actually, my wife was the first caretaker of it. She works for the county parks. And in the 2009 meltdown, that was one of their budget cuts that they did. And so what I do there now is I maintain the existing landscape, but we're also going through a phase of removing a bunch of the overgrown stuff, which is creating kind of a fortress-type effect, and going to replant a bunch of little stuff that's a little drought-tolerant like it always right now, but kind of open it up a little bit more instead of feeling like there's a wall.
And so you spend a couple of days a week doing that and the rest of the time on the bikes. Is that sort of how it breaks down for you?
Yeah, pretty much. I'm there for about 5 hours a day, twice a week. This time, right now, I'm there 3 days a week because of this little project that I just described. But all the rest of the time is on the van. Tuesdays are almost always spent in SQIM. You know, I try to wrap all my Tuesdays up, all my SQIM jobs up in one day, even if it makes it a long day. And then on weekends, most weekends during the riding season, I'm at the cabin out on the ODT to service the bikes out there. But otherwise, I go as far as Kitsap.
Before we leave the courthouse, I just want to take a moment to ask a question. A lot of the old buildings in Port Townsend supposedly have ghosts or spirits, and I've heard rumors that the courthouse is one of those buildings. Are you aware of anything going on up there in the spirit world?
Well, no, I'm not. I did live in a house that was considered haunted one time, and I have one small experience that kind of made me half believe it, but I've never heard anything at the courthouse.
Okay, what was your experience? I'm just nosy.
Well, I was living in a house uptown, and it's a house where a man had, I forget exactly which one it was. David Hero owns the house. And one time I was in the house by myself, and I had gone upstairs. There was a dance studio all at the top, and I had gone upstairs to make sure the windows were closed and everything because there was a major windstorm going on. And there was a teacup sitting on this table that was there. And I was going down the stairs, and I heard the teacup fall, and it was broken on the floor. Now, it wasn't on the edge of the table. It was several inches from the edge of the table, and there was no air moving in the room. And I decided that I was just going to turn my back up and leave.
That seems like a sensible decision to make. And it does not seem provable to me either that it was a spirit, but it might have been, right?
Right. And, because my brain works in a more scientific way than that, I just basically said I'd have to have more evidence than that.
Let's talk about the trail and what's happening with both that trail and the Larry Scott Trail. And I heard the name Larry Scott Trail, bantered about everywhere, and I'm aware of it. I've even been on it a few times. But tell us the story. Where does the name come from? Who was Larry Scott?
Larry Scott was an artist. He was one of a fairly big group of artists that came here from the University of Washington in around 1976. Tom Jay, he died last year. He's the bronze sculptor that was there. There's a bookbinder. Her name's Hollingsworth. She lives in Port Townsend with several other people. And Larry Scott kind of came into the fray when the Boy Scouts sold the Gibbs Lake property, which is now an 800 and some acre park. They sold it to Mankey Timber, which is a Tacoma company, and Mankey was going to log it. And this was about 1984 or so, I'm going to guess. It might have been a little bit after that, but I don't think so. And so Larry Scott had a friend named Rick Tollefson who lived out, and Rick Tollefson was on the parks board for a long period of time. That's why there's a Rick Tollefson trail. And he lobbied the commissioners to basically sell a piece of land down, he and a bunch of other people, to sell a bunch of land to Mankey down in the Coil of Thorndike area to protect Gibbs Lake. So that was Larry's first movement into the community and getting involved in things. And he kind of called, when he did Gibbs Lake, he said, I'm done. That was too much. And then the railroad, there used to be a railroad that went between Port Angeles and Port Townsend, and they abandoned that. And the commissioners had a chance to be able to purchase the railroad right away, but they didn't. But Larry Scott got really involved in this thing that was called Rails to Trails. It was a nationwide group, and he started looking into this whole thing. And he managed to convince the commissioners at the time, I'm pretty sure Denison was one of them at the time, managed to convince them to buy the first stretch, which went through the port of Port Townsend. I think it went all the way to Cape George Road, but maybe not that far at first. And it took a long, long time. And then Larry in the middle of that, he actually never got to see it finished because he died of brain cancer at about 44 or so. And his wife continued the work. They had a company called Brass One, and she continued doing that as well. I don't think that she actually had anything to do with the name being attached to it of her husband. I think that just came from the commissioners.
And what is the ultimate goal with the trails? What are you trying to accomplish? Not just you, a bunch of other people as well.
So there's the trail that's coming from Bainbridge Island, which is they're trying to get from Bainbridge Island to the Olympic Peninsula. There's a trail that's on Whidbey Island, which is called the Rhododendron Trail. They're trying to get that to Port Townsend. And then from Port Townsend, they're trying to get to Clallam County, and then from all the way through to the Pacific Ocean at Lapush and or possibly other places. Right now, Jefferson County, Larry Scott Trail gets as far as basically Four Corners Road. They're working right now at this point trying to get over Eagle Mount, which is a pretty big hurdle. There's a lot of land acquisition that has to happen. Clallam County has gone from the county line all the way out to Sappho, which if I had to guess, that's pretty much almost, it's got to be over 85 miles of trail. I don't really know for sure. I take care of a couple miles section out near my cabin. And they are now working on a phase that is going to take them from the Sappho, basically the Sold Duck Fish Hatchery, up through an old road that's called Pavel Road, which will take them to Whitcomb Dimmel. And then they will cross 101 and go down through Rainier's Land and meet where the Lapush tribe is pushing 5 miles of trail up from Lapush. And that particular project, I think, is going ahead pretty soon.
So the ultimate goal, then, is to link all the way from Bainbridge out to the coast? Is that how it, what's the biggest extent of it? And roughly how many miles are we talking about?
Oh, at that point, you would be easily considering as close to 200 miles easily. That is the goal. But also, there's another goal. There's a statewide trail system which is trying to all link up ultimately and connect all these trails together. And that's quite a ways down the road. But that's the real goal, is to have a basic method for people to be able to get around the state and not use little, if any, of our highways.
Wow. And so it's basically for hiking or biking, pretty much.
Hiking, biking, horses. If you want to walk, you can walk, you know, anything you want.
And some of these actually run through or quite close to town. So in theory, you could stop and stay for a couple of days in whichever town.
That's exactly right. And that is one of the reasons why Clallam County has been such a major, major advocate of these trails, is because their trails pass through three major towns. You got Squim, you got Port Angeles, and you got Forks. Oh, yeah, and then one other thing they're going to do is on the Fork side of it, when they go down by through the Solbuck, they're actually going to put a swinging bridge across the Clawa that will take anybody they want to into downtown Forks. There used to be a swinging bridge there years and years and years ago, and that's actually being done by a Green Coat Timber. They're doing that on their own. As a matter of fact, the timber companies out in the West End have been one of the best advocates for this. They've worked really hard to help this go forward.
Why? What's in it for them?
Well, number one, timber companies are required to use a small amount of their land for public use. They don't want you back in a car, but they also make a benefit out of it by having you back in their timberland. You're a set of eyes that are looking at what's happening on their property. So that helps them in some ways. And the other side of it is, although I've never heard this, but there's part of me that thinks that the timber companies say, if we get the bicycles off the road, it makes it easier for our drivers to get our product to the mills.
Yeah, okay. I can see that. It makes sense.
You know, And right now, as an example, on the Olympic Discovery Trail last weekend, we saw probably at least 36 loaded tourists, you know, and those people are spending money in the county.
And has that number been growing steadily in recent years?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It seriously started. Well, it took the public a long time to figure out that they don't have to ride on 101. They can get on this road, which parallels 101 and goes basically alongside the Solduck River. It really took the public a long time to understand it. And now, because of social media, it's out there. You hardly ever see a cyclist on a section which is parallel to the ODT on 101. If they can be on the ODT, they're on the ODT.
Well, we're running fairly short on time, but I did want to come back to something you mentioned a minute ago about this swinging bridge. That where exactly is that going to be, and what's the span? How long?
So the swinging bridge that would go over the Clawa. So if you go on the 101 bridge to Forks, the last bridge that you cross before you get into Forks, that's the Clawa River. Just before there's the road that goes down to Lapush. About a mile down the road, not even a mile, it's about 3/4 of a mile down the road, there's a piece of Rainier land that's bordered up next to a piece of land by Green Crow. And that bridge going across right there would probably span at that point, probably 150, maybe 175, maybe even as much as 200 feet. There's a swinging bridge that Molly and I went across on our tour up in Vancouver Island a couple of years ago, and that was easily 200 feet. The way they do these new swinging bridges are just fantastic, and it would be wide enough to accommodate two-way traffic of loaded cyclists. I've seen the concept. It's a fantastic job. Green Crow, they're absorbing all the expenses on it.
Yeah, I've seen a couple in British Columbia that are quite amazing, but I hadn't seen any in Washington State.
Well, the swinging bridges that used to be here, they're all gone. We're actually literally swinging on ropes. The West End used to have, they were just covered with them. That's how people got around out there. Because don't forget, at one point, people didn't have cars, and they needed to cross the river to go to the store.
True. One last question, because it has impacted everyone. What did the COVID crisis do for you and for your industry as well?
The bicycle industry kind of went into the COVID crisis a little bit under inventoried for, you know, reasons that we don't really need to go into. Then when COVID hit, there was a lot of people that didn't want to be on transits or anything like that. And so a lot of people suddenly decided to get bicycles. The floor units that were available were a little bit down. And then so what people did, once they bought up all the floor units that were available, everybody took their bike that was in their garage and they had it repaired. And that pretty much ate up all the available inventory. And at the same time, there was no manufacturing that was going on because most of the pipe parts are coming out of Asia. And as a matter of fact, there's still a lot of parts that aren't available, a lot of parts that aren't available because there's no metal to actually make the part because of various shutdowns around the world. Right now, the industry is really kind of really in a tailspin because you can't get some parts. Like I tried to find a set of pedals for a guy the other day. We went through like 9 different brands and we couldn't find one set of pedals. The industry is just really in a bad state, as are all the outdoor industries. It isn't just the bike industry. All the industries are really down.
So there are supply chain issues for you as well as a lot of other people.
You know, I've said this, you know, if there's anything good to come out of COVID is that we fix our supply chain problems. If you look down the road and 10 years from now, we still have the supply chain based on this current formula that we had. Boy, we didn't learn anything, I don't think.
You know, when we talked before, you told me that when you were a young man, you pretty consciously made the decision that you did not want to go to the big city. You wanted to stay on the Olympic Peninsula. Has your view ever changed, or what do you feel about that now?
No, I could never live in the city. No.
Well, Mark, we're basically out of time. I want to thank you so much for being a guest on the show. You've been listening to Our Town on KPTZ, Port Townsend, 91.9 FM. I'm your host, Marianne McNellis. My guest today has been Mark Hilt, owner of Shining Star Cycles. In addition to thanking Mark for being a guest on the show, I also want to thank Karen Anderson, editor and producer of Our Town. Karen will use her technological magic to massage and distill what we're saying. We will sound ever so intelligent and much more eloquent than we really are. She'll iron out our verbal stumbles and mumbles, you knows, and stuff like that. I also want to thank you, the listener, for sticking with us during the era of COVID. We're all trying to make it through the crisis together. KPTZ Port Townsend is a community radio station. Everyone who works here is a volunteer. We give our time because we all believe Jefferson County needs a free local voice. We need you, dear listener. We need more volunteers. We also need more donations to stay afloat. Like all businesses, we have a lot of expenses to pay. And we'd really, really like to return to some form of normal. So listeners, stay safe, stay healthy. I'm signing off for today. But please keep listening to KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM for more dynamic, informative community radio.